Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to start in the aftermath of yesterday's election by talking a bit about leadership and the need for mandates to act. In particular, I would argue, with respect to the most important threat to the security of our country, namely that posed, as we talk about a lot here, by the Chinese Communist Party. I'm delighted to have with us for this purpose a man who has provided such leadership for many years, notably in the uniform of the United States Navy, as one of its senior and, I would argue, certainly most competent naval intelligence officers. He is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He served in his last duty station as the chief of intelligence for the Navy's Pacific Fleet, a very important position, especially because it is, of course, in the front lines of the struggle with the Chinese Communist Party. And we regard Jim as one of, well, not only our greatest duty experts on China, but really as one of our leaders as well, in making the case that we have no choice but to stand up to and defeat this mortal threat to our country and to freedom more generally. Captain Fennell, I salute you for all of that and welcome you, as always, to this program. Glad to have you back.
Thank you very much, Frank, for those kind words. Glad to be with you.
Well, they're heartfelt and, in this case, fully deserved. Let me ask you, sir, you're watching from overseas. The spectacle, I think, is not too strong a term for it, of our election process. As we are speaking, we don't know the outcome of the elections for either the House or the Senate. They may be resolved by the time this program airs, or we'll have perhaps greater clarity about it. But I wanted to talk to you, sir, about this problem of leadership, because it seems to me that when you have, on the one hand, a majority of the American people in poll after poll after poll, the voters specifically I'm talking about, saying the country's headed in the wrong direction, and you have a great disaffection for the commander-in-chief, who, if history is any guide, would normally lose powerfully in some cases, but certainly lose in midterm elections, which turn out to be a referendum on such presidents. For all those reasons, it would seem that this should have been a crushing moment for the Republican Party in both the House and, I would argue, the Senate too. It hasn't been, at least so far. To what extent do you think, as I do, that this is a failure of leadership on the part of the Republicans in both the House and the Senate to articulate clearly a platform with respect to China in particular, but more broadly, for that matter, that distinguished them dramatically from the opponents and not simply cast them as kind of not quite as bad as those guys, which is what they seem to have defaulted to, more or less? Your thoughts, sir, as a man who has demonstrated, as I say, real leadership in the past and knows the importance of it now.
Well, Frank, I mean, we don't know the results of what happened yesterday on Election Day. But it seems like that maybe the results aren't as some had predicted with this red wave. And my concern about that is that we continue to keep having inside the conservative side of America, which it's not a party. It's just your belief and understanding of the foundation of the nation and a dedication to the Constitution, that we keep having a debate on whether or not we should run to the center or run harder to the right, as some people characterize it. And some people said, you know, and our pollsters say, run to the center. And it seems like we continue to be defeated. And we have, I think, a pretty clear picture this morning that somebody went farther to the the Constitution and into the value of individual liberty versus collectivism, the Chinese model, in Florida. And that state now has certainly seemed to have done and given their people hope, and it's been a resounding success. So I'm not an expert in domestic politics.
Specifically for Governor Ron DeSantis, essentially exhibited that kind of leadership. I couldn't agree with you
right.
more.
Right. So, I mean, I'm not an expert in domestic politics, but what I would say is, what I don't see is, and I'm here in Germany, giving some lectures today, and I was asked by people, you're telling me about China, Mr. Fennell, but I don't hear anything in your midterms. No one's talking about China. And I said, yeah, that's right. So nobody from the left or the right, where we're told repeatedly that there's a bipartisan consensus in Washington about China, yet not one Democrat or Republican that I saw was platforming on, hey, the real existential threat is the People's Republic of China and their desire to destroy the United States of America. And so I think...
And, you know, the irony of this is, Jim, that every one of these people, if they actually succeed in getting into office, they're going to have to contend with this.
Correct.
And they should have talked to the American people about it. They should have sought a mandate for what they would do about it. And that's one of the things that is so, it's not just galling. I think it's a failure of leadership. And it starts with people like Kevin McCarthy in the House of Representatives who offered a somewhat platitudinous commitment to America, which offered, among other things, a joint select committee on China, which is good, but it doesn't really speak to what we now know about this threat and the need to deal with it. Mitch McConnell, of course, deeply compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, was nowhere to be seen at all on this subject. And between the two of them, I think that too many running for office under their banners were inadequately prepared and certainly not encouraged to speak to the voters about this problem. And Jim, I'm on a bit of a bender about this. I forgive me for taking your time to say this, but let me just add, this is in the immediate aftermath of the Chinese Communist Party having used biological warfare to kill so far over 1 million Americans. And if we're not going to talk about it under those circumstances, for heaven's sakes, let alone make clear what we're going to do to, you know, hold them accountable for it, make it costly to them. Well, I fear we're going to get a lot worse from them in the not too distant future. And that's the subject to which we're going to turn after this very short break with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, one of our country's foremost experts on the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, its military capabilities, yes, but more broadly, its ambitions, the danger they represent to all of us, and what we must do about them. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. As of now, the outcome of the races that will determine control of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives remains unclear. Specific candidates and local issues are factors, but given the palpable and well-documented anger of a majority of voters about the wrong direction in which the nation is headed and the historical losses that first-term presidents' parties suffer in midterms, the Republican opposition should have performed far better. That would have required, however, leadership in Congress that articulated and pursued a robust platform for corrective action and explicitly sought a mandate for achieving it. Compare the failure of Senator Mitch McConnell and Representative Kevin McCarthy to provide such leadership with the crushing success of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who fearlessly did. The former should have the grace now to yield their positions to others actually willing to lead. This is Frank Afty. Captain James Fennell is on board, I'm happy to say. We're very pleased to have him always, but particularly at a moment such as this, when in the aftermath of the elections of 2022 here in the United States, we're in desperate need of his counsel about what we need to do about the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it represents to us, both of the kind that it's been pursuing for some time now, the so-called unrestricted warfare, pre-kinetic, if you will, and that may be in the offing, very much of the traditional, conventional, and horrific kind, namely military aggression. Captain Fennell is these days a fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours here in Washington, but we appreciate very much his leadership, not least in the Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which he has been a founding member. Captain Fennell, we've explored the failure of leadership to date. Let's talk a little bit about what we need to do now. We had a webinar yesterday at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, about the steps that are needed. Maybe it's a joint select committee under Republican control. Maybe it's something else. But give us your thoughts, sir, about the sorts of things that the United States must do now, if it is to hopefully deter worse from the Chinese and defeat, if it comes to that, the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, Frank, I tend to focus on the kinetic arena. I live in a world, and you live in a world, where everybody walks around with a phone in their face and talks virtually like this and thinks that our lives are in a virtual reality. We have this thing called metaverse, which is insane to me. But anyway, that's what most people in the world think about. But we have distanced ourselves from the whole reality that there is kinetic power and that life can be very short with metal, sharp objects piercing your skin and ending your life. And so I'm reading a history of Nimitz at War written by Mr. Craig Simon. And he talks about in 1940, the Congress passed the Two Ocean Navy Act that built the U.S. Navy that at that time was not prepared for a war either in Europe or in Asia. And in the first 3 years of the war in the Pacific, Admiral Nimitz had no more than four or five aircraft carriers in total during the first 3 years of the war. And he frequently had to use one or two only carriers in some of the major battles that we know about. And it wasn't until 3.5 years later that the first carriers that went into production from that 1940 act started showing up in the Pacific. And we started to see scores of aircraft carriers, like the Battle of Leyte Gulf, some 15 aircraft carriers under the command of Admiral Michener. It took something, though, 3 years when we had a shipbuilding production capacity that was second to none in the world. And so if we're going to do something, it's going to take us making a dramatic turn to say that our existential existence as a nation is at risk. And I'm afraid we don't recognize that. But if we don't start building up our military power, China will not be afraid to take military action against us and our allies, and they will use it. And we will like to say, well, Putin wasn't very successful in the Ukraine, so therefore we don't have to worry. I'm assuring you that their capabilities in the PLA are learning the lessons from Ukraine and have superior weapons and superior mass than what Russia has. And we better be prepared to produce the kinds of equipment. And we can't wait. Committees aren't going to cut it. We need to act now. Time is not on our side.
PLA, of course, is the People's Liberation Army. And one of the things that I wanted to run by you, Jim, we've talked about it with some of our other guests since I first heard it from Richard Fisher, who is another of our duty experts on the Chinese military. He says, in his estimation, now that Xi Jinping has been coronated as the first Chinese communist emperor, and thereby, we presume, squared away pretty much his political situation, the military of China, and by that we mean really the whole of society, as you know so well, is now ready to go against Taiwan and can, without notice, the indicators and warnings, the kinds of mobilization and the like that we might see and then be able to respond to, hopefully in time, he thinks is not going to operate here. And I've had others, including our friend and colleague, Grant Newsom, Colonel U.S. Marine Corps retired, say the same. Do you agree? And if so, doesn't that make vastly more urgent the kind of very, very urgent activity that you're talking about?
I agree, Frank. I mean, we know that there was an article written here in the last couple of weeks by a former CIA intelligence officer, John Culver, saying that he sees no indications and warning of any PRC invasion of Taiwan for at least 2 years, probably much longer. And that's going off of an indication and warning list that goes back to a different era and doesn't take into account dual use, civil use facilities, the civilian population, and the fact that the Chinese have learned from our indications and warning standards and indication and warning indicator lists. They have learned how to deceive and defeat those. So the idea that we're going to have all this time to warn ourselves, it seems to be a presumption that we shouldn't risk the lives of 330 plus million Americans on. We need to be prepared that they're going to come like a bolt out of the blue, like they talk about in their writings, and to strike fear and death into the people first of Taiwan and our American and Japanese forces in the first island chain and maybe other places, Guam and even Hawaii.
Yeah. Or perhaps even here on the mainland, who knows? But and this is such an important point, Jim. And again, it makes simply unconscionable the failure in the course of this national election process. I mean, obviously local elections, not presidential ones, but in the course of this election cycle, that point was not made clear. That we're looking at not only the distinct prospect of Xi acting on his repeated threats to use force against Taiwan, but that it will entail attacks on our forces, our personnel, our assets, our territory, as well as other friends of ours out there, when they go for it. Take it to the bank. And this seems, I guess, beyond imagining for a lot of civilians in this country. You know, as you say, they're focused on other things, to be sure. But even the ones that are focused on China seem to think, well, it's going to be a bad day for Taiwan, but, you know, we'll sit it out. I don't think so. Especially with Joe Biden as commander-in-chief, compromised as he is. So again, it brings us back to where we began. Military preparedness is one thing. I'm so glad you emphasized the importance of a defense industrial base. Unfortunately, that's not something that we can turn on like a light switch. Give us a sense, as you see it now, especially, Captain, as you say, with the Chinese having learned lessons from the Ukraine exercise, what they've taken away with respect to the immense amount of kit that we have given the Ukrainians that might otherwise be available for the Taiwanese or for our own defense against China.
Yeah, we talk about I&W, about what we can see them doing. What we don't realize also is that they have their own I&W list about where we're at, where our strengths are, what our readiness conditions are, how much ordnance have we sent to the Ukraine, and where our stocks are at, and what's the status of our four deployed naval and air forces, and how ready are they? And as they see those things deteriorate, plus given the domestic situation and our lack of attention and a lack of a real bipartisan consensus to confront China, it seems like we're signaling them it's okay to go. And let me just say one last thing. Exactly. We know
I'm hard out of time, Jim. I'd love to have you come back, though, for a longer conversation on all of this. Thank you for your time today, sir, and Godspeed in Germany and your travels. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we're going to speak with Elaine Donnelly. We'll get into some more of this readiness issue.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're going to continue a discussion of readiness in the United States military, topic we touched on with Captain Fennell in the previous block, with a woman who has devoted her life to assisting the United States military in assuring its readiness. In fact, it's the name of her organization, the Center for Military Readiness, which she founded and has led with extraordinary aplomb and effectiveness over decades. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. I think it's one of the most important organizations in the country, frankly. Not often recognized for the work that it does because that work is mostly obscure to the rest of us. But I can tell you that people in uniform appreciate the work that Elaine Donnelly has done and is doing to speak for those who do not generally have a voice, at least in public policy matters, because of the disciplines and strictures of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. She has a voice. We're always delighted to have it here. And I want to thank you, Elaine, for all you do to speak for those men and women who cannot, as I say, be adequately heard, and including on matters like readiness and the factors that contribute to it or detract from it. Jim Fennell has made the case powerfully as you know, we need the only military we have to be as formidable and as ready as it can possibly be at a time when enemies, notably the Chinese communists, are contemplating going to kinetic war with us. We want to deter that. Talk about the challenge we're currently facing with assuring the readiness of our military from an unlikely quarter, namely the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Commander-in-Chief, Joe Biden.
Well, we count on our military to deter enemies and to fight and win wars. And the assumption has always been that the military is a meritocracy, that people are promoted and put into positions of high rank because they're the very best that we have. Well, guess what? Before the United States Supreme Court, the Solicitor General of the United States, representing the Department of Defense, made an argument that no, color blindness, meritocracy is not important. The Solicitor General said that racial quotas are more important, that this is necessary. It's a national security imperative. It's an argument that was made, it's not the first time, back in 2003, in a case called Grutter versus Ballinger. It had to do with the U of M Law School. A similar argument was made by an amicus brief, and the Supreme Court, unfortunately, bought it in a 5-4 decision. Sandra Day O'Connor said, well, we'll allow racial preferences because the military needs them in order to have racial balance between officers and enlisted ranks. That was the argument then. That was the argument made a week ago before the Supreme Court. But she said, in 25 years, we probably won't need racial balancing quotas anymore. But this Department of Defense wants these quotas to continue indefinitely. The good news is there is an amicus brief now before the Supreme Court, and it's filed by a group called Veterans for Fairness and Merit. They have over 600 members. I think 21 of them are Medal of Honor recipients. Most of them have combat experience, people of high rank. And they're saying to the U.S. Supreme Court, no, color blindness and meritocracy is more important. And they also pointed to evidence that West Point, for instance, has a way of discriminating to have a balance of racial groups, but it discriminates against Asians. I should mention the case before the court is on behalf of Asian and white students at Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Those are civilian schools, but they have ROTC programs. So the DOD says, well, we have to have racial balance. And of course, it would affect the military service academies, depending on how the decision goes.
And when the term racial balance is used, Elaine, really by definition, this is a subjective matter. The quotas are arbitrary. But what you're getting at and what this amicus gets at is that arbitrariness is at odds with the idea of merit being the basis upon which people are admitted and promoted.
It is percentage based. Everything has to be figured out by numbers. So evidence was presented that certain minority groups that are favored, even though they have lower scores and grades in high school, they are being accepted into these universities at a higher rate than Asian and white students with much better grades, test scores. And we know that attrition rates are higher among that favored group. So we know that going out into the military branches, we have officers who are being promoted who may not be the best. So people have to think, well, if I have a son or daughter in the military, do I want them led by the best qualified person or someone who meets a minimal qualification who may not be as prepared for what is involved in direct combat? I think the answer here is very clear. But again, here we have Department of Defense saying, well, we have to have the same percentage among officers as you do in enlisted ranks. Well, the racial balance already is pretty good, but they're saying the difference between the officers and the enlisted is important. Otherwise, there will be disastrous consequences, as we have seen in history. Well, I've looked into the history. There have been times where racial incidents tore the military apart. But what the Department of Defense is doing with critical race theory instructions, pitting race groups against each other, is far worse than what the DOD is saying is where we should not go now. So their argument really does not make any sense. But if the justices defer to the Department of Defense, that's a legal principle. Historically, they usually defer to the DOD. Even the conservative justices may end up being misled. And I don't think so. They were very skeptical.
They certainly were. And looking at this case, you know, more broadly than just the service academies, obviously, and the military itself, you know, Tucker Carlson makes the point that you did a moment ago by talking about brain surgeons or pilots of airliners. You want the best qualified. You want them there on the basis of merit and performance and being rewarded for both. But here's the other piece of it, Elaine. And again, this is one of the things that I so admire about you personally and about the Center for Military Readiness is you have a deep appreciation, which very few civilians do, of the culture of the military and the implications for the rank and file, everybody in the military food chain below the commanding officers needs to have confidence in the quality of their leadership.
It's
not
so
enough
important
that they just be somebody who got a passing grade to be fit, but isn't actually the best we can put in that particular position, especially if they're going to tell you to go put your life in jeopardy. And as you said about the CRT, this critical race theory, a part and parcel of it, of course, is its deep animus towards the United States of America.
That too.
As a systemically racist country and as filled with oppressors historically and presently. And, you know, for heaven's sakes, this is not the kind of thing that is likely to inspire people to want to put their lives on the line for the country, even if they do have confidence in their leadership. But especially right. If that leadership is telling them, you know, take a board and be indoctrinated by and be graded on the basis of critical race theory. And oh, by the way, some artificial quota that puts me in charge of you. This is insane.
The biggest threat to our military as a superior military, it's not just the hardware, although that certainly is a matter of concern because we don't have budget keeping pace with inflation, but the recruiting crisis, which is only getting worse. The Pentagon is clueless about what to do about it. Well, they need to inspire confidence in unity, not diversity. Diversity is a good thing. Okay, we want diversity. But you can't do it by deliberate discrimination against racial groups because of assumptions about the color of their skin. That is the definition of prejudice, to prejudge people based on their skin color. And that's what critical race theory instructions do. They have them at West Point, all the service academies. And yet in the military, a lot of people say, oh, no, we don't do that here. Yes, you do. If you are following the leadership of this Secretary of Defense and all of his subordinates, including people at the Department of Defense Education Activity and the new diversity chief and chief diversity officers, CDOs, it's a regular diversity industrial complex at the Pentagon.
And effectively, they've insinuated, as I understand it, kind of political commissars throughout
right.
this ranks.
Right. It would be a great victory if the Supreme Court strikes down the principle that it's okay to discriminate on the basis of race. This would be a great victory. But we're very concerned that there might be a carve-out for the Department of Defense. It wasn't raised in the oral arguments. It was only hinted at. To say, well, okay, Harvard and North Carolina University cannot discriminate, but the Department of Defense can because it's a strategic imperative. That would be a disaster. You know, we have ROTC programs at universities. You have to get into a university to be in the ROTC programs. So a carve-out would be, well, not enforceable. It would stick out like a sore thumb. It would be demoralizing and divisive and destructive to the strength of our military.
I trust all of those arguments are made in this amicus brief, which
yes.
I've not had a chance to read, but we all should, and most especially, I'm hoping that Clarence Thomas, who has been particularly effective in this, you know, case and the hearing of it to this point, is taking that very much to heart. Elaine Donnelly, thank you. We appreciate you so much. Keep up the great work. Come back to us again soon. We'll be right back with Ambassador Yoram Ettinger on Israel and Us right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We are going to be talking about issues foreign and domestic with a man I've come to admire tremendously for his acumen about both. He is a distinguished retired Israeli diplomat who served for many years in this country, understands it very well, as indeed he does his own country, of course, but also the very dangerous part of the world in which it finds itself, namely the Middle East. His country is Israel. His name is Ambassador Yoram Ettinger, great friend and tremendous resource for this program. We're always proud to have him with us. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back, sir.
Thank you. It's my privilege. Thank you.
So I want to talk to you about your election, but I'm also interested in your thoughts about ours. And let me just stipulate that we don't know the full upshot of the elections, particularly at the federal level, who will be controlling the House and Senate as we speak. That may become clear shortly, maybe not. But how is this being seen from both your own personal vantage point and more generally by the Israeli people?
Well, it seems to me that the midterm election have a significance which transcends the district level, state level, and U.S. national level. It has to do with the safety of the free world. It has to do with the national security of every one of America's allies, and specifically Israel, and watching the outcome and assuming that the Republicans will regain majority in the House. This could have a very significant impact on U.S.-Israel relations, on U.S. national security, just considering the fact that rather than De Lauro as chairwoman of appropriations, you're going to have Kay Granger from Texas chairing, namely the sensitivity towards national security, the awareness that U.S. posture of deterrence should be the number one element of national security, transcending the diplomacy, transcending appeasement, transcending embrace of rogue regimes. That by itself sends a clear message. Then you're talking about two very critical Appropriations Subcommittee. Betty McCollum is today the chairwoman of Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense. She is going to lose that seat. So will Barbara Lee, the chairwoman of Appropriations Subcommittee on Foreign Operations. both of those two congresswomen belong to the very, very radical wing of the Democratic Party, and they control until January 2023, they control much of U.S. national security, foreign relations. That is going to take a dramatic change to improve again the U.S. posture of deterrence, let alone Adam Smith, the current chair of armed services, shifting now to Republican chair Mike Rogers from Oklahoma, who's definitely is a national security hawk. The chairman of intelligence, Adam Schiff, of all place, of all persons, he will lose power, replaced by a Republican. All that certainly have a direct major impact on U.S. national security, and therefore on Israel's national security and on U.S.-Israel strategic cooperation.
Mr. Ambassador, let me just say that the reason you know so much about the United States Congress is that you served as the Israeli congressional counsel for the time that you served here in the Washington office, the embassy. You probably know more about the Congress than most Americans, including those who just voted. What, of course, we don't know for sure is whether, you know, the outcomes that you've just described will eventuate. I think they will, but we can't say for certain at this moment. But thank you for that short course on what's at stake. And it makes all the more painful the fact that it isn't absolutely clear what kind of majority will govern in the House. Let me turn to your election, if I may, sir. Bibi Netanyahu finally won not only an extraordinary further term as the premier of Israel, but also got a majority in the Knesset, an actual governing majority. Did he get a mandate in the process, sir? And if so, what is it? And what are the prospects that he will act faithfully on it?
In my humble mind, the reason he won election, the reason his coalition won election, has to do with something which is very similar to what's happening in the U.S., namely erosion of posture of deterrence. In recent months, there has been intensification of Palestinian terrorism, of crime, and the Israeli constituents have taken notice of that.
Including inside Israel.
Right, inside Israel, inside the pre-67 Israel, inside Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, inside Jerusalem, inside Tel Aviv. And the message has been, we want enhanced, we want restored posture of deterrence, and now it's in the hands of Benjamin Netanyahu. And the big question is he going to restore posture of deterrence? Will he learn from the very grave mistakes of his short-term predecessors, who just like the Democratic Party in the U.S., our own so-called Democrats have deluded themselves that concessions and gestures and appeasement to rogue elements in our neighborhood is going to pay off. And it has provided tailwind to rogue activities.
Absolutely. Hold the thought, Mr. Ambassador. We're going to come back with more, including about a new initiative of our Center for Security Policy that we hope will be helpful in all those respects. Be right back with Yoram Edinger right after this. Welcome back. We're visiting with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, a longtime now retired Israeli diplomat, a man deeply knowledgeable about this country, as we've just been talking about the prospects for changes in our government. And we're also discussing changes in Israel, the return of Benjamin Netanyahu to power. It seems to me, for reasons that you've described, Mr. Ambassador, that there is an urgent need not only for Benjamin Netanyahu to be very robust and effective in restoring deterrence within Israel and vis-a-vis its adversaries, and we'll get to one of its foreign adversaries in a moment, but also that he be supported in doing all of that here in the United States. And I just wanted to mention that we launched on Monday of this week a new coalition. Our organization, the Center for Security Policy, is part of it and has helped put it together. We call it the Committee to Renew the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. And its object is to stand shoulder to shoulder with Prime Minister Netanyahu and his coalition, and to restore, among other things, the support that it has long enjoyed based on this idea that Israel is our uniquely and most important ally in that very turbulent part of the world. And it's something that went over the side, our colleague Dr. David Wormser said, rightly, I think, with the Oslo Accords, of which you were a very strong critic, in favor of an arrangement whereby we had sort of a policy of moral equivalence and equal status, really, accorded to both the Israelis on the one hand and the Palestinians, usually favoring the latter under governments that profess this. Talk to us a little bit about how important that kind of solidarity with the United States will be in this moment, and the need for that special relationship to be restored.
Well, I would refer to it as an initiative of the mutually beneficial U.S.-Israel relations, or initiative of the two-way street U.S.-Israel relations. And for too many years, Americans have lost sight of the fact that Israel is not really a recipient of foreign aid. Israel happens to be a platform of a very, very valuable American investment, which yields a return on investment of a few 100% every single year. The initiative that you're talking about is going to leverage the unique capability by Israel to be a major force multiplier for the U.S., force multiplier for the U.S. economy, U.S. Force multiplier for the U.S. Defense. And in fact, Israel has been for many years now the battle-tested laboratory for the American defense and aerospace industry. Israel has been the laboratory for over 250 American high-tech commercial giants, which are leveraging the brain power in Israel. And such an initiative would render the American taxpayer a major, major ROI, return on investment, rather than consider Israel a worthy recipient of foreign aid. Israel is neither foreign, nor do we ask for aid. We ask for partnership. Obviously, we are by far the junior partner, but this is a partnership which benefits both sides, not one side alone.
You know, nobody makes this case better than you do, Ambassador Yoram Edinger, and I'm so grateful to you for doing so on this program faithfully, because it is really the underpinning point of, this coalition, yes, but really, I think the work of all of us who appreciate the importance of Israel. It is a mutually beneficial relationship, and the stronger it is, the greater that mutual benefit will be. Let me turn to this foreign adversary that is, I'm sure, top of mind for Benjamin Netanyahu, as it was during his previous stints as Prime Minister of Israel, namely Iran. There's two things happening simultaneously. One is that the people of Iran have clearly demonstrated, I think in really a way we've not seen since the original Islamic Revolution, that they want to be rid of this government. And they're willing courageously to put themselves on the line to try to bring that about. But at the same moment that the regime seems to be teetering, it is perilously close to getting its hands at long last on nuclear weapons capabilities, if it has not already done so. Talk about this challenge and how the new coalition government in Israel under Benjamin Netanyahu will likely contend with it.
Well, in fact, the Iranian threat, which is a threat not primarily to Israel, not only to Israel, it's a threat to every single pro-American Arab country. It's a threat to African allies of the U.S. It's a threat to Central Asia allies of the U.S. It's a threat, in fact, to the U.S. itself, as evidenced by the Iranians re-entrenching themselves along with Hezbollah terrorists throughout most of Latin America, all the way to the U.S.-Mexico border. And Israel, again, here serves as a major ally which extends the strategic hand of the U.S. without a need for a single American soldier. For instance, Iran today is very active through Syria.
We have to stop, Mr. Ambassador. We're just hard out of time. I apologize for cutting you off. There's much more to be said about this. We'll look forward to doing it with you in the near future. In the meantime, thank you for all you do, my friend, at the Edinger Report. Check it out, folks.
Thank you.
Come back to us again next time, if you would, for more of how we can protect the country we love. Until then, go forth and multiply.